Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with me now is Anish Chopra, who was the U.S. government's first ever chief technology officer. Appointed by President Obama, he served from 2009 to 2012. He has now written a book called Innovative State, How New Technologies Can Transform Government. Anish, welcome to WNYC.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
So your appointment and other early acts of President Obama and the way that first campaign was run in 2008, so successful in the digital realm, led to a lot of hope that we were entering a new era of government transparency. But the Obama administration has been frustrating to the press and to transparency advocates for actually being very closed. So why the disconnect in our most connected White House?
Well, I think there's really two conversations on transparency. One is a more political nature, which is communications with the White House more directly about the president's goals, objectives, what his policy intentions are. And the other is more in the operations of government, transparency in the day-to-day billions of records that are in government vaults that now are being made publicly available at no cost to the taxpayer for entrepreneurs and innovators to repurpose and reuse to improve people's lives.
But you have to be a journalist or some other deep digger with a lot of time on your hands and a lot of knowledge about how to use databases to go through all those records and produce anything of meaning for the public, right?
Actually, there's a growing industry of companies that are actually doing the complexity, reducing the complexity for you. So you can find startups like Socrata and others who make really easy interfaces for the American people to build new products and services. And you have stories, I comment on the book a great deal, of folks on weekends really writing applications to help people live better lives.
And we'll get to more stories from the book, but this keeps coming up from my colleagues in Washington with the frustration with the Obama White House. For example, on March 17th, the Washington Post published an article called Sunshine Week, Transparency Issues Persist with Obama Administration. And it says an Associated Press analysis of federal data found that the Obama administration has grown more secretive over time. Last year, censoring or outright denying freedom of information access to government files more than ever since Obama took office. It says the administration has also cited more legal exceptions to justify withholding materials and refused to turn over newsworthy files quickly, and most agencies took longer to answer records requests, according to the AP study. And I could go on. So you're out of government now.
Yeah.
You don't have to defend them. How frustrated are you by the difference between promise and reality on Obama openness?
I'm actually very hopeful and excited, and I'm not really negative on it. We opened up, for example, one of the most sensitive databases on this question, which is who comes to visit the White House. The visitor logs had largely been seen as private, security-oriented data. But the conscious decision by President Obama to open up the White House has meant that everybody can look up who came to visit me, a lonely staffer, as well as others in the White House. And that has led to a great deal of transparency and accountability, which I think is an incredibly important step.
And
the last point is, even on the Freedom of Information Act requests, the fact that we're even becoming more transparent as to where they are in the queue, what's the pace at which they're being resolved positively and negatively, and now agencies even putting up the data sets that were called for under FOIA, that's all steps as a process matter in the right direction.
Anish Chopra with us. He was the first chief technology officer of the United States, appointed by President Obama, served 2009 to 2012, has a book now called Innovative State, How New Technologies Can Transform Government. Anybody from the tech sector or the Personal Democracy Forum world, where I know a lot of people, some people who listen to us are working on that intersection between technology and open government, 212-433-WNYC. We can sprinkle in a few phone calls here, 433-9692 for Anish Chopra. And part of your book is an open innovator's toolkit.
Yes, sir.
And item one is open data. Making government data accessible is essential, you say. So what would you say that you accomplished along those lines, and how would you grade the administration on that outside of your own work?
Well, I would say, number one, my personal role really was about implementing the vision that the president set out. So we put forth a series of memoranda and policies that turned the default setting of government from closed to open when it comes to data sets that the public is already entitled to. The creation of the website data.gov is sort of a physical manifestation of that. There are literally hundreds of thousands of data sets, and there are hundreds of companies that now hold new products and services born out of the consumption of that open data. McKinsey recently estimated that there's between $3 and $5 trillion of economic value associated with the ability to pull open data in a half a dozen regulated sectors of the economy annually. So I think the culture shift and the movement towards openness is a critical success. I give it sort of a B plus in the sense that we've got the infrastructure, we've got the culture from the top, and we've got now a movement, slow as it is and moving in the right direction, at the agency level to adhere to the goals the president set forth.
When you say economic data, do you mean this can also be used to help companies make money? Not just for political openness, so we know what our elected officials and their appointees are doing?
In fact, that is the central tenet of the book, is that people can actually make lots of money and help us solve problems at the same time. So if you take a look at healthcare, if every patient in America made the right decision about what care to get, in what setting, and at what time, we would save 30% of the healthcare dollar. There will be companies who will help advise or guide or encourage patients to make those better choices. If they take a nickel or a penny in helping to reduce billions of dollars out of the healthcare system, we would say as a country, thank you for your entrepreneurial success.
You're a brave man to bring up healthcare in this context. Did you have any role as CTO in healthcare.gov?
We all had a role, and I would take an important point to say that, look, we obviously saw this as a very important policy matter. The key challenges we saw in healthcare.gov's rollout had a lot more to do with agency procurement decisions, which clearly nobody at the White House had anything to do with. Agencies have that responsibility. It's really a sadness, if you will, in our IT acquisition system that you can't have a truly fair and open competition if you want to get something done in a timely manner. Because what happens now in Washington is if you put up a bid and a company loses, they have the immediate right to protest, which could take months, if not years, out of the system. So it required the agency essentially to bypass the full and open process to more of a convoluted model to get the thing done on time. So I think fixing IT procurement, the president said it, top priority.
Government procurement procedures, not a sexy topic.
No.
But does it mean, is what you're saying, that they hired the wrong contractor to roll this out?
I think they asked the wrong set of folks to bid on the contract. In other words, they only allowed a half a dozen companies who were pre-qualified to do government work to be the group that would be responsible. If they widened the aperture to people who may not have a history of government procurement but are really good at building healthcare insurance marketplaces, that might have had a slightly different outcome. And by the way, I have a chapter of the book specifically around bypassing these models of procurement that are broken by focusing on challenges, prizes, and competitions to get folks who may not be traditional participants to get involved. And that's, I think, a huge opportunity for savings for the government.
Which happens increasingly in the private sector these days, it seems to me. We see these hackathons and other things where, okay, you have 48 hours to design the next great tool for X, Y, and Z.
Here's the central tenet of that. I was with Sheryl Sandberg, who's the chief operating officer at Facebook. She made a very astute comment. At the time we were on stage, she had about 3,000 employees working on the Facebook platform or working in Facebook. But she had done a search on the internet. Who holds the job title Facebook developer? It's 30,000 people. They're not on her payroll, but they're helping build products and services to make Facebook better. And so I draw the analogy to say we are a nation of 3 million federal workers, but 300 million people. If we could leverage the 3 million by multiplying, force multiplying up to the 300 million by opening up data and encouraging its use, we would have a ton of creative minds helping to solve health, energy, education markets. And that's a key tenet of an innovative state.
So how can some of my tech-minded listeners who may hear this and say, yeah, that's really cool, I want to help in my free time, how do they actually go about doing that in a practical way?
Well, the great news is there's actually an active movement to try to put this data to use. I talk in the book about Health Data Palooza, an annual gathering, which is now a must-attend event. It happens in June every year. John Bon Jovi, who's here in New York, actually participated to drive more creativity to say, hey, in his case, John asked the public, can you help me help homeless folks actually find available beds in our community? So it's an open data set. set. You know, where are all the open beds for all the homeless shelters, and can we help people like John's soul kitchen staff help direct folks to the right place? That is an example of what you can see in this movement.
My guest is Anish Chopra, who was the U.S. government's first ever chief technology officer appointed by President Obama. His new book is Innovative State, How New Technologies Can Transform Government. And let's take a call. David in Nassau is identifying himself as a federal government employee. Hi, David.
Thank you for your service. Thank you for your service.
Well, you're welcome.
So what's your question, or what do you do?
I work for the Department of Housing and Urban Development. I don't want to get too involved because I'm on the clock right now.
Uh-huh.
I was just kind of wondering what your guests thought about how the federal service on the inside is implementing technology well. I'm going to raise the sticky issue of the age of the civil service. I'm younger. I'm under 30, and there's not many of us working in the federal government. I think the younger folks are a little more eager to get new technologies. Some of us have, more abilities like programming capabilities and things like that we're very eager to use. And sometimes it's hard to get either our coworkers or our supervisors or, obviously the massive behemoth bureaucracy to kind of move forward in technologically advanced ways. And I was just wondering what you guys thought about that.
Thank you.
It's a phenomenal question. What we're seeing is one of the case studies I wrote about in the book is Jeff Bezos's culture at Amazon, where he encourages frontline workers to actually help bring about new products and services. In fact, he has a Nike shoe, kind of Just Do It award to celebrate that culture. And so we instituted a great number of policies that allowed frontline workers to participate in these very same codathons and hackathons. The questioner asked me sort of two different issues. One is the day-to-day software that young man on the phone is using probably is outdated. It's not modern and up to date. But that's okay. When he goes home and he's on his app, his iPad or whatever he's got, he might want to consume data that Housing and Urban Development has made publicly available. He might want to combine that data with other information sources to help people make better decisions. Here's a small example, Brian. I don't know what this person's job role is, but imagine all the folks that get housing vouchers. They have Section 8 housing vouchers, which is a program at the Housing and Urban Development. It gives them a choice as to where they should get their housing. Well, what if I told you that we made publicly available a list of all the underperforming Head Start centers in America? Would knowing that the Head Start center in a given community is not performing well encourage you to not choose that location? So what can a Housing and Urban Development employee do to give folks information about where the bad performing Head Start centers are so they can make smarter choices about where to live? There's no reason why they couldn't do that, and a frontline worker like this gentleman could build that app over a weekend and make it available in his community, and others could follow suit.
Ways to use data at HUD. Roger is calling, and he says he's on the board of directors of the Society of Environmental Journalists. Roger, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Real quick, because we're running out of time.
All right. The Obama administration may be good at putting out selective databases. However, they are extraordinarily closed when it comes to providing access to journalists and allowing reporters to talk to the actual experts in those departments who know what's going on. For example, we have members who deal with issues in national parks, and park rangers are not allowed to talk about conditions right there in front of them. They should refer you to a PR person in Washington.
And Roger, I'm going to leave it there because we are running out of time. But can these two worlds connect? This is back to where we started the interview.
Yeah.
But
I'm
maybe there's a lot of data getting released to somewhere where people with technical skills can go and find it. But there's this other sense among many journalists of the Obama administration's closedness.
So I don't know the specifics of the Park Service, but here's what I would draw as an analogy. Assume the the Interior Department, kept a database of the cleanliness or the workforce conditions or whatever this gentleman's question has to do with park conditions. If that database exists, if they've maintained something, the presumption now under the president's open data policy is that data set should be publicly available. For example, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has made available a list of all the food deserts in America. Where are the places in America that it's difficult to get access to high-quality nutritional food? So one question is, can I interview somebody? And I'm sensitive to that debate. I'm not a journalist, so I obviously don't understand the value. But if the raw data is in a database, asking for that data to be publicly available on data.gov is an absolute priority and tied to the innovative state.
Roger, there's your next task. And we leave it there with the book, Innovative State, How New Technologies Can Transform Government, and Anish Chopra, the author who was the U.S. government's first ever chief technology officer. He served President Obama from 2009 to 2012. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Up next, Armando Iannucci, creator of the HBO series Veep.